Good afternoon, brethren. Happy Sabbath. Brethren, I'd like to start off today by inviting you to explore with me some failures and successes in the Bible. And as we get started, I'd like for you to do something here. I have on my watch a timer set for 30 seconds. And in these 30 seconds, what I would like you to do is think about and write in your notes who you consider to be the greatest failures in the Bible. So don't get started yet. Ready? Go. 30 seconds. Just whoever you consider to be the greatest failures in the Bible. Five, two, one. Okay, thank you. You know, and think about it, you know, this is a good, eats up time. You know, I should have set for like 10 minutes or something, right? Okay. Thank you, brethren, for doing that. Let's get started, brethren, by turning over to Exodus chapter 1. And we'll start looking at some examples, some accounts here of failures and successes. Exodus chapter 1, and we're going to begin in verse 1, and now this is after Israel and his sons, they moved into Egypt, and they settled in the land of Goshen. The first few verses here talk about the children of Israel, the names of them who came in with Jacob. And we see here in verse 6, it said, "And Joseph died, and all his brothers, and all that generation." Verse 7, "But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them." Now, if you read the UCG commentary, you'll see that they have a note in here about this, and it's talking about how this is Abraham beginning to bless Israel. Look at how it's described here, increased abundantly. It says they multiplied, they grew exceedingly mighty. The whole land there was filled with them, that land they settled in. Verse 8, "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to his people, 'Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happen, in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land.' Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. They built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramesses." Verse 12, "But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor." And you know, brethren, Egypt is a type of sin. And it's true, sin is a hard taskmaster, isn't it? Sin is really cruel. Verse 15, "Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiphrah and the name of the other Puah. And he said, 'When you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live.' But the midwives feared God, and they did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive." And we read here how the king of Egypt called for them. And he said, "Why have you done this? Why have you saved these male children?" And the midwife said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them." Now, some commentaries say, well, from working out in the field so hard, they were in better physical shape than the Egyptian women, and so it was easier for them to give birth. I don't know, but I do believe that God's hand was in this, and he was taking care of them and working things out for them, obviously. "Therefore," in verse 20, "God dwelt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. And so it was, because the midwives feared God, that he provided households for them. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, 'Every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive.'" And if we continue reading, brethren, in chapter 2, then we read about Moses and how God preserved his life. And so we see here, brethren, a failure, this failure on Pharaoh's part. He tried to destroy the children of Israel, because if he was to have succeeded, then that would have wiped out Israel, killing all those male sons. But you know, brother, just as Egypt is a type of sin, so Pharaoh also is a type of Satan the devil. Moses, a type of Jesus Christ. So in looking at this failure, brethren, we see not only did Pharaoh fail, but Satan the devil failed. Satan failed in trying to destroy Israel at that time. So we see here in this example where Satan fails, God prevails. Satan fails and God prevails. Now let's turn over to Exodus 14 and look at another example, another failure. And this is after Israel, they started to leave Egypt. They went out with a high hand. We see here in Exodus 14, verse 1. Exodus 14, verse 1. Now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi-Hahiroth between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. Verse 5, now it was told the king of Egypt that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people, and they said, why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us? You know, brethren, as God calls people out of this world and out of sin, as we're heading towards baptism, and even after that, Satan doesn't want to let you go. He'll pursue you even harder, just as Pharaoh here was pursuing Israel. Verse 6, so he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. Also he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with boldness. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea, beside Pi-Hahiroth, before Baal Zephon. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. See, they were going out on a high hand. Everything was fine. But then as soon as they used their eyes, and they saw what was going on, and they saw the Egyptians coming after them, it all disappeared. They just got terrified. Verse 11, then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. Verse 13, what does Moses say? Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace. He said, don't be afraid. And the Lord said to Moses, verse 15, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. But lift up your rod and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots, and his horsemen. Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and horsemen. And then we read here, brethren, where it says, the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them, as it says, and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud of darkness to one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. Verse 24, it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. Verse 25, and he took off their chariot wheels so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians. Imagine how that looked, brethren. Imagine how that looked. Here they were going after Israel, and God chooses to take the wheels off their chariots. We know there's at least 600 of them. There's tons of chariots. Imagine the massive confusion that was going on that God caused just by simply taking the chariot wheels off. What does that tell us, brethren? Well, one thing it tells us is that when we're going through a trial, and even if Satan is pursuing us, God knows all the details. He knows how to take care of us. He has a plan for you, and he has a plan for me, brethren. He can take care of us any way he wants. And here he chose with them to take off the wheels of their chariots. Verse 26, and the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the water was coming from the side of Egypt. Pharaoh's army turned around, they were going right into it. There was no way of escaping. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained, but the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea. And the waters were a wall to them on the right hand and on their left. So the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. So we see another failure, brethren, a failure again on Pharaoh's part. And once again, a massive failure on Satan's part to try to destroy Israel. Once again, we see where Satan fails, God prevails. And something else that we've seen in these two examples, let's turn over to Job. Job chapter 1, we'll see this principle here. Job chapter 1. In the first example, Pharaoh was allowed to do some things. In the second example, Pharaoh again was allowed to go just so far. And we see this here in Job chapter 1, beginning verse 6. Job 1, verse 6, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? So Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Verse 12, and the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. What do we see here, brethren? We see that Satan can only do what God allows him to do. And it's always for God's purpose. It's always for God's purpose. That should be encouraging to us, brethren, as we go through life, when we have our ups and downs, our trials. Something I thought that was interesting about these verses as well, something else, is when we read here in verse 7, Satan tells God that he's going to and fro on the earth and walking back and forth on it. Now, in my mind, another verse came to my mind. It was 1 Peter 5, verse 8. 1 Peter 5, verse 8. Let's turn over there. That'll help us understand a little bit more about how our enemy works. First Peter 5, verse 8, over 6. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him, for he cares for you. Verse 8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Again, he walks about like a roaring lion. And when I looked at this, brethren, I wondered, well, what do you mean a lion that's walking and roaring at the same time? Because I always thought lions roar when they're about to pounce or when they're about to, you know, do whatever they're going to do, go after something. Not just walking around and roaring. Let me read to you what Barnes' commentary says on this, as a roaring lion. It says this, quote, sometimes Satan is represented as transforming himself into an angel of light. And it references 2 Corinthians 11, verse 14, which is true. And sometimes as here, as a roaring lion, denoting the efforts which he makes to alarm and overpower us. The lion here is not the crouching lion, the lion stealthily creeping toward his foe, but it is the raging monarch of the woods, who by his terrible roar would intimidate all so that they might become an easy prey. That tells us, brethren, that Satan walks about the earth trying to intimidate you and trying to intimidate me. He uses what's going on in this world. He is the God of this world, remember? He uses those things to try to instill a sense of fear in us, to be afraid of what's going to happen. But you know, brethren, fear is one of the great enemies of faith. Fear, doubt, human reasoning, anxious care. Because Satan knows if he can instill fear in us, then we're an easier target. Because faith can disappear if we're fearful. But we know, brethren, that Satan can only do what God allows us, as we just read in Job. And that should be encouraging to us, brethren, as we go through life. Now, let's look at two examples in the New Testament and see some examples of failures there as well. The first one is in Matthew chapter 2. Matthew 2, after the birth of Jesus Christ, and the Magi, the wise men, came and they visited Herod, and then they went and they visited Jesus Christ, who was a child by that time, by the way. He wasn't a baby anymore. Verse 12, Matthew 2, verse 12, speaking of the wise men, there were more than three, by the way, as you know. It says, then being divinely warned in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed for their own country another way. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise, take the young child and his mother, flee to Egypt, and stay there until I bring you word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. When he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed for Egypt and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, out of Egypt I called my son. Verse 16, then Herod, when he saw that he was deceived by the wise men, was exceedingly angry, and he sent forth and put to death all the male children who were in Bethlehem and in all its districts, from 2 years old and under, according to the time which he had determined from the wise men. Then we see it says this was fulfilled, what was spoken by Jeremiah the prophet. A voice was heard in Ramah, lamentation, weeping, and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children, refusing to be comforted because they are no more. So we see here, brethren, another failure, this time by Herod. Herod tried to destroy Jesus Christ. Just as Pharaoh was a type of Satan the devil, here Herod also was a type of Satan the devil as well. So we see another failure from Satan, where God protected Jesus Christ. Something else I think is interesting here is in the dream to Joseph. It says here in verse 13, he tells him, arise, take the young child and stay there. Go to Egypt. And we read in verse 14, he said, when he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night. He didn't wait. He didn't say, well, wait a second. Can I wait till morning when it's light out? After I have my coffee and donut? Can I have some breakfast? Can I just, you know, hang out? Because, you know, it's safer to travel during the day. I can see what's going on. It's probably much more dangerous to travel at night. You know, there's all kinds of crazy animals out there. There's robbers, bandits, whatever. Well, Joseph didn't do that, did he? He got up that very same night when he knew what God's will was, and he left. No fear. No fear. He just did what God told him to do. Now, it could be easy for us to say, well, yeah, but you know, Jesus was right there with Joseph, so of course he was protected. But you know what, brethren? We also have Jesus Christ with us 24/7. You know? So when God says, go do something, do we put it off? Do we make excuses? Do we let fear get to us? Or do we just say, yes, God, and do what he says? One more example over here, a few more chapters. Matthew 4, it's very familiar. This is the temptation. Matthew 4, verse 1, then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterward he was hungry. Now when the tempter came to him, he said, if you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. But he answered and said, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Then the devil took him up into the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he shall give his angels charge over you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. Verse 7, Jesus said to him, it is written again, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. And here we see in these verses another tactic of Satan the devil, taking the scriptures and twisting them. You know, we saw earlier about how he has his ministers become, act as ministers of light. He'll twist the scriptures, try to tell us it means something it doesn't mean. Of course, Jesus Christ wasn't going to fall for it. And verse 8, again the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, all these things I will give to you if you fall down and worship me. Then Jesus said to him, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and ministered to him. So we see another colossal failure on the part of Satan the devil. Later, Matthew 16, verse 18, Jesus Christ said he would build his church. Who would build his church, and the gates of hell or the grave would not overpower it. Now see, brethren, this is where we come in. This is where we come into the picture as well, because we are part of that true church. We are part of those whom God has called out of this world. granted us repentance, let us be baptized, given us the gift of his Holy Spirit. We are the one, part of those that are here to overcome and grow in holy, righteous character, preparing for the return of Jesus Christ when he establishes the kingdom of God here on this earth. And he says he would build his church. Let's turn over to Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians chapter 2. Ephesians 2, verse 19. It's Paul writing to the Ephesians. He says, "Now, therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord, in whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit." Again, let me read to you what Albert Barnes' commentary has to say about this, this being fitted together part. The church is being built. It says this, quote, "Fitly framed together. The word used here means to joint together, as a carpenter does the framework of a building. The materials are accurately and carefully united by mortises and tenons so that the building shall be firm. Different materials may be used and different kinds of timber may be employed, but one part shall be worked into another so as to constitute a durable and beautiful edifice." It goes on to say, "So in the church, the different materials of the Jews and the Gentiles, the people of various nations, though heretofore separated and discordant, become now united and form a harmonious society." And we see here in verse 21, it says, talking about the whole church, "in whom the whole building being fitted together grows into a holy temple." And then verse 22 refers to the work God is doing in us individually. Now, brethren, keep this in mind as I show you a few slides up here. Show a few slides and also a small video. Turn it on. Okay. This is the Horton House in Jekyll Island. Now, if you've been to Jekyll Island for the feast, you've probably driven past this or you've stopped and taken a look at it, right? The Horton House, so, you know, it's right up on the northwest of Riverview. If you're driving up, here's the ocean on this side. You go up to the north, there's a campground, and then when you start coming back down right there on the northwest side, that's where the Horton House is. That's the Horton House. There's another picture of it. Let me read to you some information about the Horton House. Major William Horton was one of General Oglethorpe's top military aides. Horton was in charge of troops garrisoned at Fort Frederica on nearby St. Simon's Island. In 1735, he was granted Jekyll Island by the trustees of the colony of Georgia. Following a Spanish attack that destroyed his first house on the island, Horton rebuilt the home that still stands today in 1743. Brethren, this house has been standing for 279 years. Through all the bad weather, through all those hurricanes, it's still there. What caught my attention was the type of construction, as you'll see here in a minute. It's called tabby, is the construction. You may be familiar with it. To make tabby, early Georgians, they would burn oyster shells to create lime. Then they would mix that with sand, crushed shells, and water, and they'd make this mortar that was then poured into forms for construction. Here's the video. It's a small, it's about a minute long. It's a walkthrough. As we're walking in, you'll see some shells on the floor, on the what used to be the floor, on the ground. And you can start to see that tabby construction here in this room. Now, another family, after the Hortons died, they got the home and they added some other additions to it. But you can see here This is that tabby construction. And notice the shells, the sand, the mortar, the way it's all constructed and pressed together. And it's been there for 279 years. See another example of it. They're on the wall. And here's a more of a close-up picture of it. And here's one even closer. And notice how the shells are all compacted. Everything is just tight. It's just there. It's sturdy. It's strong. Remember what I just read to you about Ephesians 2, 19 through 21, about being fitted together, fitly framed together, meaning joined together as a carpenter does the framework of a building, materials carefully united so the building shall be firm. Different materials may be used, different kinds of timber may be employed, but one part being worked into another so as to constitute a durable and beautiful edifice. In the same way, brethren, as this tabby was constructed with the different shells and the lime and etc. to become that strong structure, so God is also using us, brethren, to build a strong church, collectively and individually. And just as in tabby, the materials were those shells and sand, lime, and so on. Those represent the different trials in our lives, the different experiences we go through, yes, even the failures, as long as we get up and keep going. And all those things God uses that we go through to build us up individually into what He wants us to be. He wants us to be like His Son, Jesus Christ. Let's turn over to James chapter 1. There's one more, a little bit closer. James 1. Verse 2. James 1, verse 2. My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. See, brethren, there's a purpose for these things. There's a purpose for the various trials in our life. And yes, even when God allows Satan to go after us, it's still according to God's purpose. Because God loves you. He loves me. He loves all of His people. And He wants us to be in His family. So He's working with us to grow in that holy, righteous character. Go back and read sometime Hebrews 11, that faith chapter. We'll see some of the trials that some of those heroes of faith have gone through before us. And there are times when they were killed. God let that happen. But it was all still according to His purpose. Because in the end, they win. Romans 8, verse 28 says this. Says, and we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are the called according to His purpose. The J.B. Phillips translation says, moreover, we know that to those who love God, who are called according to His plan, everything that happens fits into a pattern for good. Brethren, God will see us through. God will take care of us. We may stumble along the way, but God wants us to keep going. He wants us to get up and keep going. Let's look at 2 Timothy 4. Be our last verse here, 2 Timothy 4. That's two verses. Verse 6, this is Paul writing. He says, for I'm already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand. Verse 7, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Finally, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved His appearing. Brethren, let me end today by reading a poem to you. You may have heard this before. It's a poem about getting up and keep going. It's attributed to Dr. D.H.D. Groberg, and it's about a race, and it's about not giving up. Satan will want us to give up, brethren. Let's never give up. It says this. It says, whenever I start to hang my head in front of failure's face, my downward fall is broken by the memory of a race, a children's race, young boys, young men, how I remember well, excitement sure, but also fear. It wasn't hard to tell. They all lined up so full of hope, each thought to win that race, or tie for first, or if not that, at least take second place. Their parents watched from off the side, each cheering for their son, and each boy hoped to show his folks that he would be the one. The whistle blew, and off they flew like chariots of fire. To win, to be the hero there, was each young boy's desire. One boy in particular, whose dad was in the crowd, was running in the lead and thought, my dad will be so proud. But as he speeded down the field and crossed a shallow dip, the little boy who thought he'd win lost his step and slipped. Trying hard to catch himself, his arms flew every place. Amidst the laughter of the crowd, he fell flat on his face. As he fell, his hope fell too. He couldn't win it now. Humiliated, he just wished to disappear somehow. But as he fell, his dad stood up and showed his anxious face, which to the boy so clearly said, get up and win that race. He quickly rose, no damage done, behind a bit, that's all, and ran with all his mind and might to make up for his fall. So anxious to restore himself, to catch up and to win, his mind went faster than his legs. He slipped and fell again. He wished that he had quit before with only one disgrace. I'm hopeless as a runner now. I shouldn't even try to race. But through the laughing crowd, he searched and found his father's face with a steady look that said again, get up and win that race. So he jumped up to try again, 10 yards behind the last. If I'm going to gain those yards, he thought, I've got to run real fast. Exceeding everything he had, he regained 8, then 10. But trying hard to catch the lead, he slipped and fell again. Defeat. He lay there silently. A tear dropped from his eye. There's no sense running anymore. 3 strikes, I'm out, why try? I've lost, so what's the use, he thought. I'll live with my disgrace. But then he thought about his dad, who soon he'd have to face. Get up, an echo sounded low. You haven't lost at all, for all you have to do to win is rise each time you fall. Get up, the echo urged him on. Get up and take your place. You were not meant for failure here. Get up and win that race. So up he rose to run once more, refusing to forfeit. And he resolved that win or lose, at least he wouldn't quit. So far behind the others now, the most he'd ever been, still he gave it all he had and ran like he could win. 3 times he'd fallen stumbling. 3 times he rose again. Too far behind to hope to win, he still ran to the end. They cheered another boy who crossed the line and won first place, head high and proud and happy, no falling, no disgrace. But when the fallen youngster crossed the line in last place, the crowd gave him a greater cheer for finishing the race. And even though he came in last with head bowed low, unproud, you would have thought he'd won the race to listen to the crowd. And to his dad, he sadly said, I didn't do so well. To me, you won, his father said. You rose each time you fell. And now when things seem dark and bleak and difficult to face, the memory of that little boy helps me in my own race. For all of life is like that race, with ups and downs and all. And all you have to do to win is rise each time you fall. And when depression and despair shout loudly in my face, another voice within me says, get up and win that race. Brethren, no matter what happens in our lives, no matter what we may face, let's never give up. Let's never surrender. God loves you. He's working with you. And God will see us through.